All right, all good. That's nice. So, welcome everyone. It is my rather distinct pleasure to get the privilege of introducing SPAF as a part of our small technical ceremony to recognize that the UMBC Center for Cybersecurity henceforth shall be the UMBC Cybersecurity Institute. Rick has already changed all the web pages to reflect that, and as a part of that effort, we're beginning to hire new faculty. Two of those faculty are here today. One in computer science electrical engineering, Dr. David Chen, and one in public policy, Dr. Park. This year, there will be 6 faculty hires across the campus, 2 in this college, then there's 1 more faculty hired in the quantum security area and physics. This coming year, there will be 6 hires, 2 in this college, 2 in arts, humanities, and social sciences, and 2 in natural and mathematical sciences. I think the department involves our computer science, electrical engineering, information systems, physics, mathematics, economics, and then 1 more department. And how does it remember, right? So we would like to thank the state of Maryland, which has supported this transformation. There will also be, for those of you who are students here, you would be interested to know that soon there will be an announcement going out to the faculty members in this center, inviting applications for graduate fellows. So up to 12 graduate fellows will be selected and assigned to work with faculty members as a part of the state's investment. And then some things you've already seen, the cyber range that Dr. Rastogi has helped build with Jack and the OT cyber range. So we're one of the few institutions that has both an IT and an OT system working together. So you can sit on the computer and crash the electric grid and so on and so forth, at least in simulations. So
in the lab only.
In the
our own bar.
Please.
BGE crashes out.
You got real companies crashing that.
So as part of this ceremony, we are simply delighted and privileged to have Dr. Eugene Spafford, known as SPAF. Many of us, SPAF probably needs no introduction to those of you who are in the cybersecurity community. If you are new to the community or from outside, SPAF has been doing this for nearly 40 years, runs a very large center at Purdue called Sirius, which used to be COAST. I had the privilege, and this is now dating me, I had the privilege of hanging out with SPAF's first set of students in the cybersecurity area. Back then, I was a computer vision person. So SPAF has been doing this for a very long time, has made foundational contributions. And today we'll reflect on sort of the past and the future and the interdisciplinarity of cybersecurity. So without further ado, SPAF.
I am delighted to be here on this occasion. I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to elevate this to an institute level. We need more thinking across disciplines rather than narrowly within them. And as well, I've had a long association with many people here at UMBC. One notable one of your alums, was one of my PhD students, Jeff Avery, who did some great work. And I believe Josiah Dykstra, co-author in my recent book, was a graduate here. A lot of connections, so I'm delighted to be here. And what I'm going to do is give you some personal reflections. This should not be taken as definitive prognostication of the future, but what I have seen based on trends and talking with people across many disciplines. And to give you some perspective on this, I wrote my first computer program 52 years ago. So for some of you in the room, that was before your parents were born. Maybe before your grandparents, I don't think so, but it's a long time ago. And I've been working in security in some form or another for about 40 years, as was mentioned, the last 37 at Purdue. So I'm not going to give you solutions to anything. I'm going to actually try to be a little bit provocative. And I want to set the stage a bit and say the theme of this is, what is the role of technology, particularly, there are no slides. When I use slides, people pay more attention to how badly I produce the slides rather than saying. So
thank you for the clarity.
They're almost as bad as my singing. So my goal here is to get you to think a little bit about the role of computing, security, and related topics in human existence, in our lives, and our histories. And to set some of this stage, let me note that it is believed, based on some observations, that dozens of species of living thing on this planet are going extinct every week because of human encroachment and climate change and other kinds of things, habitat loss and so on. And against that backdrop and the fact that we have had multiple cycles of life on the planet, there are some interesting questions asked about our own existence and our own being that may help illustrate or illuminate some of these things that I'm going to talk about. So if I'm going to talk about humanity, an interesting question is, what are the things that define us as human? And this is not something that's a computer science term. If we leave out the theologians and we look more at psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, philosophers, others, this is an ongoing question about what is it that makes us uniquely human. And there are a few characteristics that seem to be altogether part of the human existence. Each one is present in some other species, but not all four together. The ability to reason with abstract concepts and translate those into the real world is one. A sense of time, passage of time, anticipation of the future, remembrance of the past, is a characteristic of the human condition. Communication with each other. Not only direct person to person, but methods of communication at a distance and over time. And then fourth is the ability to find and make tools to solve problems. So each one of those, and I won't go into examples, but each one of those has actually been demonstrated in some other species. But no other species has all four of those characteristics that we are, again, discovered. So the question is, where do we fit with computing in these things? And if you think about that, communication is certainly part of that, over distance and time, representation. Solving abstract problems is certainly one of those aspects. Programming language, actually computing itself is a synthetic science. It's an abstraction of real-world characteristics. Tool usage, well, we build those things. We build programs and tools and other kinds of artifacts that we use. And then the sense of time is inherent in a lot of what we do. If nothing else, at a very granular level, talking about how many millions or trillions of instructions per second can we operate on. But now if we step back and just kind of look at this broad sweep of history, communication is a trait. Physical origins for us as a species is only about 100,000 years ago, as far as we can tell, that actual changes in physiology and behavior resulted in the ability to communicate in something similar to what we have now. The ability to reason and awareness of time probably occurred about the same time. So these were evolutionary changes, according to the best evidence that we've seen from the people who study this. Civilization, as we somewhat define it, is first recorded as about 15,000 years ago. That's a really very short time scale, lifetime of the planet and otherwise. It likely extends back farther, but records and finding artifacts, we can definitively go back at least 15,000 years. As far as communication and writing goes, 5,000 years ago is about the oldest we found something, although there are some representations, ideographs, pictographs at places like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey that maybe go back further, but we don't know. Movable type to be able to have printed was invented in 1040 AD in China. That's not a very long time ago, really, in the span of things. Johannes Gutenberg in Europe was in 1450 for the European version of movable type. And despite that 1,000 or so years, literacy and the ability to read, write, and otherwise is still not universal globally. There are many places where people are not yet literate in the written word. But we're not limited to that, right? So we have other forms of communication, the telephone and the telegraph. The telegraph was 1833, much more recent. Telephone was 1875, Alexander Graham Bell, although it's arguable if he was actually the first person to develop the telephone, but he was the one most credited with it. As of now, right, so written word, not completely penetrated the entire globe. As of now, there are more phones than people in the world. In fact, there are more mobile phones than there are people in the world. There are about 8 billion people. We don't have an exact count. That's a good task for grad students if we wanted to put a good word at that. But there are over 8.6 million registered cell phones. So that is definitely more. And about another billion landlines. So cellular telephony has really taken the fore over more traditional telephones. Photography for visual was developed in the 1820s, really first the early tintype kinds of photography. It was commercially available in 1839, so it was a short time span before they made that available. Digital photos were first developed in 1969, so now we're getting more into the modern era. We take it for granted about digital photos now, because we all carry a digital camera with our phone and our address book and our cat pictures, that makes that available. First commercial use of digital photography was in 1973. First megapixel camera was in 1986. We're really getting closer in to current day. The first posting online of digital photography was in 1992 by Tim Berners-Lee. Although there was some use on the network of photography in the 1980s on Usenet, but that wasn't really the full use of digital photography. Television, now we have moving pictures, was a crude invention in the 1920s that was done with rotoscoping, and I'm not going to describe that, but it was there in the 1920s. It was refined in the 1950s. Currently, there are about 2 billion televisions in the world for 8 billion people. But over half the population has access to video via their mobile phones and computers. So it's not the televisions anymore that are dominant, it's these other portable devices. And currently, best estimates are that 52% of the population that has access watches video on at least a semi-regular basis. So that's the level of penetration. The written word to streaming video has been quite amazing. The idea of a computer, which is more specific to this area, is really an ancient idea that goes back, depending on how you want to define computer, you can look at the abacus, for example, or you can look at Thales in cuneiform on pottery tablets. But the modern computer, digital computer, as we know, it was really the 1940s, and if you know your history, that was developed for code breaking and for ballistic calculations during World War II. Those were the two primary uses at the time. It was an outgrowth of technology that had been developed in the 1930s for census tracking. The Haworth card was originally intended for what was then a massive data collection for sorting through census data, and was then adopted for use in computers. The first commercial computer was 1951, the UNIVAC. UNIVAC 1, again, closer into the modern age. The first all-transistor computer for sale was the General Electric 210. General Electric was a computer company. And it was actually one of the major computer companies back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, as was Xerox and Honeywell and some other companies that you may or may not have heard of. So that was the first one on the market. IBM announced the first one, the 7070, in 1958, although they didn't get it to market until 6 months after the GE product. And at the time, they bet the company because the computers were effectively millions and millions of dollars per computer. Before that, all tube computers would have occupied several rooms this size, occupied a separate air conditioning plant. Transistorized computers promised to be more energy efficient, but also were perhaps not as reliable, and that was a concern. The first computer-to-computer communication was demonstrated in 1965, first networking. 1969 was the ARPANET, and 1993 was about the time that what we consider the modern internet really came to the fore as something that the companies and organizations could join. Just as an injection here, to give you a sense of the age of the field, the first CS degree program, where it actually defined it as a discipline, was established at Purdue in October of 1962. So that's not a very old, compared to mathematics or physics or civil engineering, or some other field, it's an early field. So today, computing, it's hard to quantify the reach and the spread of these tools that we have built to solve problems and to cause them on occasion. But there are, by best measures, tens of quintillions of transistors manufactured every year as part of integrated circuits. Right? Quintillions is 16 zeros, give you a sense. And a decade or so ago, that surpassed all the number of grains of rice that were grown in the world for crops. It's a lot of transistors. There are, out of the 8.6 billion people, 5.3 billion have access to the internet coming online. And the growth in that population is on the order of 600% per year, which can't last forever, right? Because we've got an upper limit, but the number of people who are gaining access is increasing. And if you map that against what I was saying about literacy, a very large percentage of those people have access to the internet and they can't read or write. They use graphics, they use video. They don't actually use written word. There are about 2.7 billion desktop computers in use. So the majority of these people are online, again, doing it through mobile devices, of which there are about 15 billion. That's more than just cell phones because there are other kinds of access devices. It took us 27 years to go from 0 to 1 billion users, 7 years to 2 billion, and then it was about 4 years and 2 years to get to the next level. Currently online, about 64 zettabytes of data storage. That's 21 zeros. And network traffic is measured in yottabytes, which is 24 zeros. So that's a lot of traffic, and that's all doubling approximately every 2 years. So this is why when you read about build-out of storage at cloud providers, and you start seeing how cheaply you can get thumb drives and others, that's where all that's coming from. It's doubling every 2 years with the amount of storage with people who are collecting and storing things simply because they can. Now, in our field, 40 years ago, this is back around the time I was starting in security, it's about a human generation, as people measure it. The PC and the Macintosh were brand new products. They weren't sure if those were going to succeed in the marketplace, okay, but those were brand new at the time. Most computers at the time were mainframes or mini computers. There was one computer virus that had been found in the wild for the Apple II computer. That was it. Halcyon times, I guess. LANs were considered to be new research instruments, and people were trying to decide how they could be used. Developed out of work at the Aloha Net at the University of Kauai, early Ethernet. The maiden systems in use were DEC VMS, AT&T Unix, and IBM mainframe operating systems. So Linux didn't exist. BSD Unix didn't exist. iOS didn't exist. Android, etc. Power users of that time were in the tens of thousands at most. So it's a very small population 40 years ago. 20 years ago, we started to see commercial use of the network in significant ways. There were about 3.84 million registered hosts out of all of those computers that were developed. Only 16 terabytes of traffic, only about 200 terabytes of storage online. Interesting numbers, if you look at them, from about 2000 to the current day, that the internet of 20 years ago, this is constant moving forward, the internet of 20 years ago would all fit on commodity disks on your desktop now. That's the level of change in storage technology. It's been really quite amazing. We saw the first spam 20 years ago, a law firm, Cantor and Siegel, if you're studying these kind of things. It was basically spamming for their law services for people getting green cards. First banner ad showed up. There was no Google or Twitter at the time. It didn't exist yet. The second most common use was the World Wide Web. First most common use was a protocol known as Gopher, which is still out there. Yeah, there are still sites running Gopher servers, and some of the browsers support Gopher as a protocol. So students, you can go look at what Gopher is all about. 1991 saw the release, and that was more than 20 years ago, but saw the release of the World Wide Web and PGP. Encryption was restricted as a munition, it was even talked about. And the first digital wiretap by the Secret Service was established. So, again, this is not long ago. 20 years isn't that long. But where we're going, where we are now, and where we're moving towards is more personally tailored services, that you have the ability to customize what you're getting, your feeds, although it's very difficult to exclude the spam and other kinds of things, but what kinds of services you want to run, download apps, pay for apps, content. It's being used more in education in a lot of different ways. It's being used, interestingly, for preservation of documents. So publications of books is declining. Newspapers are largely disappearing. Physical media is effectively going away, and it's all being replaced with digital copies. And this has implications that I'll talk about shortly. We have these rich communication capabilities. We're seeing the development of 3D goggles and other kinds of interactive experiences, immersive experiences. Very expensive, and they're trying to find the right niche, but there's work going along. Haptics development, which is the physical feedback in computing, is an area of active research as well. We're seeing people being involved in embedded, personally wearable computing, the idea that you can embed computing devices into your body. This is more than just the brain work like Neuralink. This is other kinds of things, including medical devices. Entertainment, obviously. Some of it intentional, some of it not. Process control. Lots of industries are replacing people by computing equipment because the computing equipment doesn't demand overtime, works all, it doesn't have traffic jams, shift scheduling, other kinds of things, and they can monitor at very fine granularity. This gets back to the time aspect that I was talking about. We're seeing more use with monitoring and cameras for purposes of fraud detection, crime detection, CCTVs popping up in lots of places. Some countries have them very widespread. UK has them for law enforcement throughout much of urban areas. The People's Republic of China is using them for political suppression in Western China, the Uyghur population, and others. But again, it's becoming more and more widespread. And we're beginning to enter this age of machine learning and AI, where we're not entirely sure yet what that portends. That's an area of active research for an awful lot of people. It's probably, I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but a lot of what's being done with AI is probably overhyped. I see it as the current blockchain. It's attracting a lot of investment, a lot of interest, but nobody's yet identified a really good use case for it. If you follow the news yesterday, the stock market took a very deep dive because of a significant sell-off of NVIDIA stock and some other AI companies because they're not reporting anything that they're doing with AI that actually is making money. It's costing a lot, but they haven't yet identified where it can be used to make money. All right, so if you look at this trend over time, it used to be that the information we collected and processed was for historical purposes. It was that idea of education and keeping a record that we would have over time to pass on to others. So it was communication and history. That's what we really use the collection of data for. Now we're using it to make decisions in real time, often unseen by people. This is where the era of big data has come from, with things like automated trading and process control at factories. We're not using data in that regard anymore. We're still storing it someplace in many cases, but we're not using it for control. It's not something that people are using anymore. But as we've increased that usage, the protection of that information has become more critical. Because if we collect the wrong data, if we can't collect the data, if the data is contaminated, we make the wrong decisions. Well, actually, we don't. The computers do. And then we are forced to live with those consequences. Security has become all the more important, therefore, for protecting that data. Now, this is interesting because, really, I'll come back to this in a minute. But in particular, with embedded sensors and actuators, you can have very big disasters very quickly if those sensors get the wrong data or the actuators are given the wrong control information. There have been about a 10,000-fold increase in data points over the last 5 years in terms of places where these sensors and actuators are located. And most of those are being built on top of commodity operating systems, like Windows or Android and Linux, which were never really designed for real time and were not designed for this kind of sensitive application areas. Huge security challenges there. When we start looking at building stress, structure stress, where these sensors are, health monitoring, utility and management, environmental monitoring, energy efficiency. And we're finding more now where they're embedded in us as individuals. So if you have an iWatch, you have several sensors you're carrying around on a regular basis. If you have a phone that tracks the number of steps you take, that's sensors that are built in. And so we are each becoming data points to be collected. And that collection, you may not know all the places where it's going. But decisions can be made on that. So my iWatch, for instance, has the sudden motion stop detection that assumes that I've fallen and can't get up or been in a crash. And every once in a while, particularly when I'm out working in the yard, it'll start beeping and saying, "It appears you've fallen. Do you want to call for aid?" No, I'd like somebody else maybe to cut the brush, but... So there are decisions that are being made. There are assumptions being made by these sensors. Some of them can be much more safety critical, like embedded pacemakers and insulin pumps. But as I said, these have been designed really without security in mind. The collection of data has just been increasing at a huge rate. It is impossible to clean it. There is no large database now, generally. I mean, I can't say no, absolute 100%, but by and large, the majority of data sets that are in use for any of these things have never been vetted by a human to make sure that they are correct and clean. That is, that there's no anomalous data in them. And often some experiments that some of you may run with some of these data sets, you will discover anomalous data that you didn't know was in there, but it contaminates whatever it is you're trying to do. And we have to build around that. And it's becoming increasingly permanent. So I've talked to people at large corporations where they collect data on their customers and their users. And they've got data that's 15 years old from customers, including addresses and credit card numbers and other kind of information. Every once in a while, it gets leaked because someone breaks in and they download the data set. And in conversation with them, say, you know, if you didn't keep all that data, it's stale and you haven't used it in 10 years, you wouldn't have to worry about it. The answer is, it's commingled with their other data. It would be more expensive to clean it than it would be to just buy more storage to handle it. So we have this permanent growing data store of information that is stale, is incorrect, and in many cases is vulnerable. So all of this brings about security challenges, and there are others. So there's the apocryphal Willie Sutton quote that, you know, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. He never actually said that, but basically the intent. Now all the money's online. Stock trading is online. Your banking applications are online. All your banks are online. Payroll systems, purchasing, it's all online. So that's a place where the cyber criminals are targeted. And they can target more than just the information. They can also target the underlying processes that are used, the programs, the sensors, the decision algorithms, to have outcomes that they want. It's not just the thieves, it's competitors in industry. And that may not be something that seems obvious, but it actually is happening on a global scale, particularly when there are national interests in some of those economic marketplaces, such as mining, petrochemicals, aerospace. Of course, there is espionage and cyber war are areas of concern. Because if you, yes, thieves may want to get into a system, but you have potentially political or ideological adversaries who are interested in getting into whole sectors of the economy. You may not take down the electric grid as part of your experiments, but it could very well be a goal of a foreign power. General anarchists are around who, yesterday, Colombia, some of the protesters over the conflict in Gaza actually had as one of their printed objectives is to dismantle the current U.S. government, which seems a little extreme, but nonetheless, there is that anarchist underlying intent. And Colombia has a very good computer science department, so it's entirely possible there's an intersection of some of those themes. Gawkers, people who are just interested, they're nosy as to what's going on in other places. Conspiracy theorists. We've had several instances of people breaking into government computers to try to find evidence of tracking in the vaccine or the hidden UFO bases or other kinds of things. And I don't think the two are actually in the same conspiracy, but at the rate it's going, who could? What happens when we start, and we already have, but we start having AI systems autonomously probing for vulnerabilities and possibly taking advantage of them? Some of that is ongoing now at the speed of computing. So for all of you who are working in cybersecurity, this is a really interesting problem. But it is one complicated by a fundamental issue. We do not have an agreed definition of what security is. Under some definitions, like some that I've seen and occasionally use, all of what I'm describing to you is part of cybersecurity. The history, the sociology, the psychology, because it goes to the appropriate use of the technology. Other places take a more narrow view that it actually has to be involved with algorithms and hardware. But this is part of the problem. We do not have a good definition of security. not intended as a plug, but if you take a look at the book that we just wrote, The Cybersecurity Myths, one whole chapter is devoted to the fact we do not have an agreed definition. You might think, well, NIST must have a definition. Yes. Well, NIST not only has a definition, they have three definitions. You get to pick which one you like. And if you don't like any of them, they'll probably be willing to come up with another. Because we don't have a good definition, we also don't have good metrics to be able to measure and compare. And that's a problem. Part of the definition of security needs to be correctness. And this is something we all struggle with, whether we're in security or not. Software engineering is really sort of the original security. If a system doesn't behave correctly, then you can't make any predictions about its behavior under stress or attack. It just doesn't behave right normally. That's a problem. And it's not something exact. We do not understand some of the basic principles still in how to build reliable computers with known boundaries on risk and behavior. After all this time that we've been doing with computing, which isn't really surprising because it's not that long. We're going back less than 100 years for anything with digital computing. That's not a long time. We still have buildings fall down and bridges fall down, and civil engineering has been around for a much longer time than computing has. This is part of the challenge that we have that's interesting, is to understand what security is, what correctness is, what reliability and robustness is, resiliency, what are these properties, and how do we go about building them in? And how do we do it in an environment where economics plays such a major role? We know how to do many things better than we do now, but people don't want to pay for it. People will pay a modest amount to use Windows. If they know how, they'll download a version of Linux, which is effectively free. Neither of those are reliable, good platforms. They work for some typical desktop uses, but you don't want to use those in a critical environment. In fact, in most critical environments, they are definitely not the first choice. There are some first choice systems. There are some very, very high quality, robust systems, and you should be glad we have them because they're in use at nuclear power plants and aviation onboard planes and others. But those cost $10,000 a copy for a license because it costs money and time using existing tools and knowledge to make that work. How many of you, for instance, in your careers coming up through a learning program, have learned formal methods? Right? That's more than most rooms when I'm in. That is a known method of getting better software, although it's cumbersome, it's slow, and it doesn't work for large systems. But nonetheless, it is an approach, but we don't teach it because most people who want to program just want to sit down and bang out code. That's a problem. Yesterday, the head of the group working to rewrite the kernel of Linux in Rust from C, which would make it more robust, quit because there's so much argument over it and so many technicalities, he doesn't want to put up with it anymore. So it puts the whole thing in doubt. When I say about robustness and about correctness, for some of you of an appropriate age, how much of your time has been spent staring at a blue screen waiting for a paper? That, if you turn that into an economic cost, is huge. And yet people don't internalize that this is a cost that if they were to pay it up front for something that was better developed and better tested, they might not have to undergo that. Part of this is security itself and software engineering are both relatively new. One of the first projects that had security as a goal was funded by DARPA in 60 years ago. Yeah, that was more than an off by one. But 60 years ago at MIT, Project Mac, that resulted in Multics. But security was one of the design goals. And they did a very good job. They came up with a number of things that Multics had. They found a few flaws doing penetration testing and otherwise, but they were fixed, and it operated for years and years as a high assurance system. We don't use many of the things they developed, like the page segment architecture, because it's slower. Think about that as an evaluation that has been made in the marketplace. We want it faster, but potentially compromised and broken. That's the decision, effectively, that's been made. That would be like saying, I want the car that's faster and cheaper, even if occasionally the brakes don't work. That doesn't seem to me to be a good decision, in part that goes back to not having metrics. The first real good document on cybersecurity challenges in many respects, the WARE report that was commissioned by the Air Force out of RAND, Willis Ware was the primary author, which is why it's called the WARE report, came out in 1970. And if you're working in security and you've never read the WARE report, it's available online. I'd suggest you look at it. You will see lots of things that mirror the current environment. The first degree in cybersecurity was established in 2000 at Purdue. 2000, right? It's not even 25 years old. All of this shouldn't be surprising as to why we don't have better solutions than we do, although it's complicated by the fact that we have these other kinds of problems with economic decisions, lack of metrics, and simply the weight of legacy, of what's already out there that's broken. People don't want to do away with Windows because they have too much depending on it, even though it's not very good. It's huge, it's slow, it has bugs. And if you look underneath the hood, current Windows 11 has compatibility with every prior version of Windows. Why? Including bug compatibility, by the way. Because there are many commercial customers who won't switch unless they can still run their old software. Much of our economic system is based on emulators of computers that are no longer made because they support the COBOL system that the software is written in, and they don't know how to rewrite it because the people who wrote it have all retired or died. So refactoring it is a problem. Research that we're involved in, there are problems there. If you look, too much of the research is on patching the existing base. Even DARPA, a lot of what they're doing is next generation systems to patch or penetrate existing computing systems. NSF, similar. You submit a proposal for a new system, you may get negative reviews unless you talk about how it applies to Windows or Linux. I've heard from many people that's happened. And if it doesn't use the Intel or ARM instruction set, again, maybe now the Apple M instruction set, but generally, reviewers, people in the research community are not interested in innovation in a way that would really let us break out of the cycle. We've gone to a measure of publish or perish, which has been the joke for a while, but many universities, departments, otherwise, we now calculate somebody's impact by impact factor, a number of articles published. Not on the quality of the advancement, it's the numbers. Trying to get tenure at a major university now without having 20 publications and brought in a million or two in outside funding, those have nothing to do with quality or your ability really to contribute to the field, and yet those are the metrics that are being used. That's broken. Funding mechanisms like your NSF, too small and too slow. You can't do a big project. You can't undertake something longer term. I will say there's a very interesting project I'm advising right now at Sandia Labs that is a 7-year project. They're involving outside as well as inside to address a very narrow part of this problem for real-time systems in a small subset of applications. So they're trying to solve it for a small slice, and they're putting over $50 million into it, which is a good start. But there are very few projects like that that are being conducted on a large scale. There's some paradoxical market forces, so we aren't going to see things from the commercial side. The marketplace favors early to market over better developed and tested. If you're not first to market, so you can get the mind share, then you might as well not try. But that means you don't spend the extra time doing the testing, the quality assurance, and other care necessary to make sure that it'll work. Ethics and law are often just completely ignored. So as an example, what many of the AI firms now are ignoring intellectual property rights and do not scrape instructions to suck in whatever data they can to get a better model for their product, because that's how they're going to advance in the market. Ethics, forget about that. And the law, well, we'll just do it now, and in a couple of years, we'll see what the lawyers say. That's not a good approach. If any of you are members of ACM, go back and read the Code of Professional Ethics. That doesn't fit. And then skewed public impact. You look at where the public, you ask the average person out on the street, and you say, who's Elon Musk? And they'll say, oh, he's a billionaire technology genius. Half of that is correct. But he's done a number of things which are really quite questionable ethically, and it continues to do so.
It's only Wednesday.
Huh?
And it's only Wednesday.
And it's only Wednesday. If you ask them, who are the Kardashian sisters? Most people will be able to answer that. If you ask them what they're known for, well, they're known for being known. Ask how many, what do they know about Jonas Salk, who is a true hero, saved millions of lives, millions of people from being crippled, and did it all, donated his patents into the public domain so that his polio vaccine could be used worldwide. We have a skewed perception of where value is and what accomplishment should be recognized. Taking this further, back to some of my original thinking, we are not thinking about the impact on the world around us. We're not thinking about the environmental impact, power. There are stories you can find where right now power companies are in a bind because the people running the big AI centers are competing with the people running the big Bitcoin mining centers, and they're at odds about who gets the power, which basically is in places where they're needing more power to run air conditioning because of climate change. So they're burning more fossil fuel, which hurts the marketplace as well as increasing heat. The e-waste and the waste from mining, from getting some of the rare earth elements, the raw materials, those aren't factors in these costs. The pollution of the mines from the people getting all the spam and the misinformation, making poor decisions in their own lives, in what they buy, and certainly we see it in the political arena with the number of false information and operations that are going on. That's not calculated or taken into account. In the market, we want clicks. We want eyeballs. We don't care if it's totally distorting the social fabric. You look at that, and we have weak attempts at legislation a lot of pushback from various parties about trying to have guardrails on what is posted. In fact, even research. We have a committee in the current Congress where they have, through subpoenas and investigation, shut down several research projects that have been attempting to find out how social influence and disinformation are affecting the public politics. Shutting down the Internet Observatory at Stanford is one example of this. So again, the marketplace, the ideologic aspects are pushing back against some of the very dangerous things that are going on. Business as it operates, as a model, has these stages. The first is functionality. Can we get the damn thing to work at all? We're past that for AI now. Get it to kind of work. Reliability. Will the damn thing please stop crashing? That's the next thing. Third is convenient. Let's shrink it so I can take it where I'm going. Price, if it's commodity, give me the cheapest. Doesn't matter about those other factors anymore. And then last of all, fashion. Can I get it in indigo or graphite? Maybe it folds up. None of those have to do with quality or reliability. Those are not stages in the business model that we have in the computing arena. Security is not a factor. It is not a market-driving decision by anybody. It's not about making it safer. And there are security companies out there. There's a lot of them. Inside, you've got RSA. It's daunting. But keep in mind, they are not interested in keeping you safe. They are interested in selling you product. Preferably product on a recurring license. That is their purpose in existence. And yet too many people who make decisions about security think that, oh, well, you know, they're a market leader. They're going to protect me. All right, so this is the context that we're in, sort of where we came from. Let me just say a little bit about going forward. There are some technologies we're anticipating, some we can't anticipate. A lot of the developments I talked about for communication and storage and otherwise were actually changes in physics, in material science, that we then took advantage of. Free. Smaller die sizes, for instance, and now we're talking about going optical systems and so on. But quantum computing has some very interesting potential benefits. But it's uncertain when we're going to get to the point where we actually have practical quantum. We've got small numbers of bits now, but it's very expensive and very difficult and prone to error. And there are some physical constraints that may get in our way. Yeah, maybe 10 years, maybe 20. Some people are questioning whether we'll ever reach the right point. But even if we do that, we're still going to need I/O. We're going to need libraries, programming, control, error correction. It's not as simple as increasing the physical capacity of the qubits. If it does come along, it's still not going to solve a lot of our problems. It's not going to solve security problems. In fact, it may make some worse. How do you verify that a quantum program is producing the right or the best results? By its very nature, it produces all the results. So some of them must be wrong. How do we know the right ones are the ones that are coming out the other end? That's an interesting question that not many people have looked at. I have yet to see any really good papers talking about security of quantum systems. So any looking for thesis topics, here's one. AIML. There is no AI right now. It's all machine learning. It's all statistical models. And anybody who tells you otherwise is trying to sell you something. We don't actually know what intelligence is, but we do know that what comes out of the machines isn't intelligence. And it's complicated by things like IP rights, intellectual property rights, correctness, the idea. It's called hallucination. It's not hallucination because there's no thought behind it. It's just bad statistical results. Human values. Where are the ethics behind what some of this stuff puts forward? It's easy to prompt some of these LLMs to generate incredibly racist, bigotist, misogynistic material with very little effort, because that's part of the data that goes into it. Where is the ethical guidelines? Where is empathy? Is anybody working on artificial empathy? That's a human trait that we should have present in our systems. We're not doing that. Instead, we're producing systems. People are firing long-time employees to replace them with AI systems because they think it's cheaper and it's going to produce better results. Those are companies that short their stock, by the way, if you don't see that happen. There are all kinds of problems around this, and how are we going to control it? And the correctness of these systems is declining because they're running out of data to train them on, and they're now trying to train them with data that has been produced by the AI systems. And all that does is increase the noise and the nerve. So there are some real, we're hitting a wall pretty soon, if we're not already at it, where the models aren't going to get better because of more data. And that's an interesting problem. That's why currently, as I said, there are a number of concerns about AI going forward. Privacy is a huge driver and is not being thought about with any of these systems like AI or the big data collection. I've already touched on that. You need to think about that. All of these things are concerning as future capabilities because they're not being, again, they're being thought of in terms of A, what can we build, and B, how can we sell it, rather than what are we doing to actually make the human condition better. Furthermore, the infrastructure is diminishing returns. It's getting more and more expensive to build new fabs for chips, and we're seeing that play out in real time. It's more and more expensive for the power and the power consumption and hosting the data sites. That's a problem. The sustainability of all of this is really questionable. That we have to ask ourselves, can we keep it up in this way? And then there's conflict, perhaps at machine speed. We have all these various actors who are involved, and they're not interested in a company dictating their national policy or what they can do, or other countries who happen to be more advanced in manufacturing or development. So they're stealing ideas and working to subvert other systems. We're seeing that play out. The Great Firewall of China, and by the way, China's not the only country. Saudi Arabia is another one, Iran is another one, there are other countries that have this. One of my students did a PhD thesis on internet censorship and they did not find a single country that does not exercise some form of censorship over internet traffic. Not one, including the US. We're looking towards laws on unsafe AI, which they're very tentative because we don't have it defined. Think about the social order that we're seeing, not only here in the US, but other places, banning books as an example. What happens when those books are online and they're stored at a data center? What happens? How does that social effect? I think what we're going to see some more of, and this is political science, is increased balkanization of the network. More walls, more partitioning, and more difficulty in sharing information across those borders. You can question whether that's good or bad or how we evaluate it, but it's coming. And if we aren't careful with AI and privacy, for those of you who are science fiction fans, the Butlerian jihad is something that may not be out of the question if we're not careful with what we do. I'll skip a little bit here on privacy. There's a lot there having to do with respecting informed consent, which most places don't do. If you sign on to social media, you're not informed, really, but you're expected to consent. And thereafter, everything you do is theirs. That's not a good ethical model, but it's the one we have for a commercial marketplace. I'd suggest find a poem by Robert Frost, The Mending Wall. It's something to look at and, of course, an inspiration there. But then, for the last bit, and this is running a little longer than I thought, but there's also the case, because correctness and resilience are part of security in some respects, there's the issue of disaster. Anytime we can have a disaster, we can have adversaries either cause the disaster or take advantage of it. So we shouldn't have disasters. What do I mean by disasters? CrowdStrike. That was not intentional. And yet, look at what it did. There are other kinds of things like that. If those can occur, if blue screens can occur, those are things that can be caused or taken advantage of. One of the things I've written about is the Carrington event, last occurred in 1859, which was a major solar flare that caused induced currents in conductors around the world, like telegraph lines, gas lines, killed people, melted down infrastructure. If we were to have something on that order now, we no longer have printed books on things. If that took out our online storage, we'd have to start over. That's bad. But it doesn't have to be a natural phenomenon. Low Earth EM bursts, nuclear bursts, can cause a similar effect. That's been shown. I won't go into that, but that affects things like not only computers on the ground, every one of your automobiles runs with multiple computers. You get an induced current, burn those out, nothing's moving. Food delivery, medicine delivery, other kinds of things. Space communications, gone. We would not be able to recover because we aren't designing for that. All right, so I'm I ran a little late here, but let me give you the conclusion, which is there's no particular conclusion. We have some incredible possibilities for our future. The technologies you all are building have the potential to really transform our lives in good ways. I think perhaps many of us who work in the field grew up watching Star Trek, and we're thinking, that's the world we want to have. But the people who are trying to make money off it are trying to build the Blade Runner future. We have to push back against that by saying it's more than the computing. It's more than making money off of it. It's what are we doing to improve the human condition? And that's not something that's normally taught in programming 101 or operating systems. But it has to be central to whatever we do next, which is why I'm so enthused at the idea of actually having an institute here to look at that, because you've got the computer science and the other fields where you can think about this together. We need to design carefully and be better informed about the consequences. And I'll close with a thought here. How many of you know what the Drake equation is? Three, okay. Frank Drake was a physicist who came up with a mathematical equation for how to estimate how many other intelligent civilizations were in the universe based on type of sun and orbit and age and so on. Number of inhabited planets. And he was discussing this at lunch at Los Alamos with some other physicists. And Enrico Fermi was there and said, okay, I worked the numbers and it's millions. Where are they? Where is everyone? We haven't discovered any yet. Maybe they're good at hiding from us. I don't know. But the question that some people said is the answer to Fermi's paradox is maybe at a certain point, civilizations end up destroying themselves. We could be on that cusp. If we let AI take over, if we destroy our environment, feeding Bitcoin mining, then we will not be around to see the next generation of computing. And so I would encourage you, think security in the large, security of humanity, betterment of the human condition. The technology is great. Let's make it better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat. That was exactly the right kind of talk to have for this diverse audience. And thank you all for coming, for staying a little bit longer. We probably have time for a quick question or two, and then...
Yeah, and I apologize. I ran over here.
Give it a try.
Please.
Amazing talk. First of all, thanks for not using slides. And I'm the guy on campus that uses slides.
We'll remind you
this focuses us on the message that you got all. What are your thoughts about trust? There's the digital trust side, but my worry is, well, you don't have to destroy the system. You just have to destroy trust in the system.
Right.
Elections coming up, banking system. If the populace thinks that the banks are untrustworthy, the banks are gone. Right? If people think that the election is rigged, it's no longer valid. All those kind of questions. So you don't actually have to destroy the systems unless you want to take down a power plant. But a lot of our civilization is based on some basic level of trust. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
There are other examples too, like vaccines.
Absolutely. Vaccines. Yeah.
We've reached a point in technological sophistication where those, to understand the safeguards, people need more education than they generally have. And that creates a political divide. That it is a part of one political view that we don't trust the elite, we don't trust government, we don't trust education. We want to abolish university, and they respond to political messaging and other messaging at about fourth or fifth grade level. It's very difficult to argue with people who don't have the beginning. I mean, there's a Dunning-Kruger kind of effect in play there. They think they understand it, but all they've done is seen 3 hours of YouTube video. And this is a real challenge for us, is how do we get them to a point where they can get educated or find people they trust who have the education to understand it. And that's a social and educational challenge that we are not meeting very well. And we don't understand some of those conspiracy theories and the disinformation amplifies it. I have argued with flat earthers. It's
not going anywhere.
It doesn't work. You're exactly right that that is at the heart of a number of these things as problems. But the way to address that really is going to be through education and through transparency. We're not very good with those things. We have a lot of things that are not transparent, government agencies and others, proprietary rights. And as a result, people don't have the information to be able to develop the trust. This is a big social issue that I think sociologists and psychologists could be more involved in.
Okay, I'll take one question, and then I think we have a question on
the topic. You know how to reach me. Oh, okay.
So, Beth, first off, amazing talk. And one thing that really interests me from some stuff you were bringing up was where you made points about how Microsoft now is building systems, font systems, to have these backwards compatibilities. Many of these systems, like the first Microsoft ones, they were developed in the 80s. People don't really know how to, you know, work with anymore. Similarly, when we talk about things like COBOL and stuff, there's a great point where within the next 10 years, a lot of the OG COBOL engineers are going to be dead. Are we approaching a greater risk, especially now as programming education is well more accessible, getting more surface level where people are using Python by default, where at some point people aren't going to know how to engineer or operate the systems that kind of build up the foundations of modern software systems and the internet?
Oh, we passed that. When some of the faculty here were in school, we learned everything from hardware to user interface. And if we had to go teach, we could teach the entire stack. There's no person alive now who could do the entire stack. It's too complex. Many undergraduate programs no longer even teach architecture as something that's part of the curriculum. Complexity is, I didn't mention, but complexity is part of the problem. We don't know how to deal with that. There's some great work that originally some works by the name of Charles Perrow, who was on the faculty at Princeton. Normal Accidents was his first book, but The Coming Catastrophe was the most recent one about the potential collapse of the internet because the complexity is beyond the point at which we know what's going to happen. Some people are saying AI is the answer to that. I think that just adds another layer of complexity. virtualization and so on just adds more layers. So yes, that is a problem. And we are not doing a good job of meeting that. Going back and it costs money to go back and simplify. And if you look at open source, polls of people working in open source, going back, only 3% are interested in going back and auditing other people's software. Everybody else wants to write their own new device driver so that they can put it on their resume, which is why Linux has got like 50 different device drivers for everything. It's not a sustainable path, but I don't know how we get off of it.
Because I guess going off of that, we're really running this risk of that knowledge being lost.
Well, some of it, economic factors help. So there is actually, I'm not sure whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, but the banking industry puts a lot of money into Tuskegee Institute. They teach COBOL. Their graduates go off and easily get jobs, six-figure salaries, but it's not portable because that's what they've been trained in. So it's good for them, but it's perpetuating the problem in another way.
And that's another example of what this institute can do. Is sitting there is someone who works on software debt. You have an honest-to-goodness software engineer who works on software debt. I think we have a final question online, and then we will need to wrap this up to get you to the...
Quick comment, Spaff says, wonderful talk. As you were concluding, I was reminded of that great line from Chief Engineer Scott when he sabotaged the Excelsior. The more complicated the system, the easier it is to stop up the plumbing.
Yep.
Question from online from Timothy. Unsafe programming languages are proven root cause of about 70% of vulnerabilities. What is the best way to incentivize organizations to transition away from legacy memory unsafe languages, i.e. C, C++, assembly, memory-safe languages like Java, Python, Rust, etc.
Java,
I would question the job.
Two quick responses to that at a time. First, no single programming language is the best solution for problems. Different problem sets require different languages. They have different advantages. Same thing with architectures, operating systems, databases, whatever else. The second thing is we need to have a balance where we give credit and investment to those organizations that do things we want them to do, but we also hold them responsible when they do things badly. Many of these companies will hire people whose entire technological background is picking up C++ for dummies and learning it at home. And we don't hold them responsible. And they get into the supply chain. So there are some things like the CMMC and some others that are working to get through the supply chain and to hold to a minimum standard. But the minimum standard is pretty low. We need to balance out better so that they can't disclaim all liability or push it off into arbitration rather than actually have some public evaluation. And that requires some fundamental rethinking and some leadership at high levels to make that happen.
Thank you very much, Beth. We really appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Beth, can you turn around quickly? I'm going to take a screenshot. Everyone, ready? Smile. Oop, hang on. I may have missed that. One more. One, two, three. Got it.
Add to the yottabytes.
Thank you, Spaff. Thank you, everyone.
Very good. I expected no less than you said it. Do you have a colleague, Byron Pipes?
Oh, yeah.
Byron was a person who was probably from Germany for what I thought was 6 months. And I'm still here. And that's my original mentor.
Oh, how wonderful.
I took over his composite center when he became almost then president of RBI. So
I don't see him very often.
Yeah. I had the feeling you run into each other from time to time.
We do. So yes. That's great.
I give you my.